Right, it's 11:10. We should be getting started. But as you can see, there's something wrong with the computer in this room. Does anybody know how to reboot a Windows machine if it's stuck? I tried the obvious of turning it off, and it doesn't want to be turned off. Sorry? No. It's just dead. Yeah, normally I would just turn the damn thing off, but I've pressed the off switch. It has no effect. Computers now believe that they know when they should be turned off rather than you know. So, okay, so if you'll forgive me for one moment, I'm going to go outside, find the servitor, get them to pull over somebody from the service that knows about this.
Seems to be the problem, just not.
Well, you can see this, it's not brought up any icons whatsoever.
I'm just using it for that.
Right. It's displaying the PC correctly. The problem is the PC is not doing the right thing. In.
Yeah.
Oh, now it's doing a log out.
Logging off, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Log out.
Could you please go and get somebody from Mott who would know how to restart the machine?
No, there's not a problem. I'll try to help you. Okay.
Thank you. Oh, there's one other way you can help. Is there another lecture room free, do you know? Right. Okay, so my apologies for this. This Malt is the service that's responsible for these machines. He's gone to fetch somebody from Malt. So unless somebody knows something to suggest about getting the machine to reboot. Sorry? If I could find the plug, I'd unplug it. Oh, microphone's off. Thank you. Different technology. Microphone should be working now. So is there a Windows expert in the house? Yes? Right, do you want to come down and try it? Because I was trying to power cycle and it didn't work. Let's see if holding the power button down for longer works. Oh! Aha! It does. See if that fixes it. Yay! But we'll see if this works. Okay, while we're waiting for Windows to do its thing, are there any questions? No, mic should be working now. People in the back, is the mic working? Can you hear me? Yeah? People in the front, can you hear me? Okay. So people can hear me at least. The machine's rebooting. Let's hope that that's fixed it. So let's deal with questions while we're waiting. Are there any questions? I know there's at least one question. I told you to wait till after class, but now would be a good time.
In the exam, we have to write the program in a blank document, or will it be in the same format as the tutorial one?
Right. In the exam, when you're asked to write a program, will it be like the tutorial where you're given a little framework in which to write it? Yes, you'll be given a little framework. So you won't need to memorize all those details.
Is it an open book exam?
I can't remember off the top of my head. You'll have to look that up. It is not an open net exam. Right? You cannot access the internet during the exam. And it's not our intention to get you to memorize details, so we provide you with access to a description of the libraries, so you don't need to go in with that memorized. But there is a danger in open book exams in that people think, oh, well, I can look that up in the book when I need it. And of course, if you need to look up a programming technique, it will take you too long. So you don't need to memorize the details of the libraries, but you do need to know all your programming techniques when you go in there. So I thought I would, by the way, I asked if we could move to a different lecture theater. There aren't any other available. So this is exceedingly annoying. I have not had this kind of problem before where I can't even bring something up onto the screen. So I really apologize for this, but it's a very difficult lecture without the lecture notes. Don't suppose anybody has a laptop that has lecture notes on them already? That would be the other way to go. Sorry? You have the lecture notes printed. I could sort of wave them at the front, but that probably wouldn't help. But you do have a laptop there. Does it have the lecture notes from yesterday on it? Could you bring them up and put them up in Acrobat, and I'll just plug it in? That would work. I should have thought that before. I forgot that everybody's equipped with a computer now and that everybody goes everywhere with a computer. The world has changed. If you can just bring up the lecture notes in Acrobat, that'd be great. Press Control, Delete to begin. Well, we'll see if it works. It was very slow before. We'll have a race.
because I have a problem with my home. I have them in here.
There you go. That was it. Bring it back. Yeah. And then you just do the control L, I think. Ah, but we need to get this set up.
I think it's on the back.
Do you need to... Sometimes you need to set up the display? Oh, it looks happy. Let's try it. Yes! Thank you. This man deserves a round of applause. Okay. Yeah, that's good enough. Right! So, last time we had abstract types, and you learned the key principle of designing good programs, which is to behave like a 5-year-old. Don't let other people play with your toys. You know the invariants. You want to write code that maintains the invariants. We learned how to do modules, how to use modules to enforce that kind of abstraction barrier. And your tutorial this week is doing something very similar with writing something once using lists and again using trees. And you'll note that the one using trees really runs a lot faster. We actually give you a large database to work with so that it's big enough that you can see the difference in time. Okay. And I'll just remind you briefly, if you've not yet signed up for the mock exam next week, you've had email telling you how to sign up, please do so. We're using somebody's laptop instead of the computer, but the computer itself, I think, is dangerously slow.
All right. No, we'll have a check when it's there.
Right, so we'll be done lecturing at noon. Maybe you could come back then and check on the machine.
Yep.
Thanks. Okay, so now, having talked about abstract types, the theme for this week is types, but we're doing two very different things. Yesterday we talked about abstract types. Today I'm going to explain about type classes. So you've very often seen types with these annoying things at the front, like eek A, double arrow, and ord A, double arrow, and so on. Today, finally, I will explain what all that was about. So, here's an example of this sort of thing, right? We're going to define element. So there are many different ways of doing it, right? We could do it with a comprehension or with recursion or higher order, just like everything we do. Right, so with a comprehension, right, to find out if X is an element. This is annoying. All right. I know what to do. I can't use... So normally I use that, but that seems to be changing the screen. But that's fine. All I need is a very big pointer. Sorry. Oh, you mean a laser pointer. Right. I don't like laser pointers. I like to actually point, but yeah, we'll use a laser pointer. No, this one's completely dead. No, we're definitely having fun with equipment today. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I want with a long, long stick. Because they're much more effective. All right, pointing will be hard. Right? Three definitions of LM. You understand those definitions, right? We're just checking whether the element X occurs in the list Y's. Any questions about those definitions? Everybody nice and bored by those, because you've seen them before? Right. So the first one, for instance, says, check that for each Y in the list Y's, is X equal to Y? And I'll give you a list of trues and falses. It'll have a true in it if some Y is equal to X. And then we just take OR of those, and that'll tell us if X is an element in the list. The other two are similar. Note that all three of them, of course, need equality. To check if X is an element in Y's, for each Y in the list, you've got a pointer? Sorry?
That's not a mouse.
Oh, a mouse. Not sure that'll work. I mean, this is a mouse, but it still is changing pages, so I don't... Whoa. Wow. Hey, now that's really impressive. Are you doing that up there? Yeah, but is it going to pay attention to this? Oh, it is. All right, let's see if that works. Cool. Where were we? Before that. Oh, I'm going the wrong way, that's why. There we go. Yes. There we are. Okay, good. So, right, all these things in blue, we're using the equality function no matter how we define it. This bit says you can use it for any type A you want, but it had better be a type with equality defined on it. But there's some types that don't have equality defined on them. Functions are a good example. Right? If you ask the poor computer, if you give the poor computer two definitions, right? One says that the square of x is x times x, and the other says that the square of x, if x is an integer, is the sum of all the odd integers less than or equal to x. Those two things happen to be equal, but the computer doesn't know that. Right? How would it find out? Well, let's try it for 0. Yeah, they're equal for 0. Let's try it for 1. Yeah, they're equal for 1. But there are too many integers to check. So it couldn't know. It couldn't test whether those two functions are equal. So we can do equality for some things, but not for others. And this says, look, it's any A you want, but only if the A has equality defined on. So integers, no problem. We know how to check integers for equality. Characters, no problem. Lists of pairs, no problem. Lists of characters, right, because that's what a string is, no problem. Functions, doesn't work. So it says, no, I don't have any instance of equality for functions. I don't know how to compare functions for equality. Okay. So that's what the type classes are about. And the way you do this is you define a class called eq of A, and you put in it what the type of all the functions that belong to this class. So here there's just one, equality. And I said equality belongs to class EK if there's a function equals equals whose type is A to A to bool. So eq int works because, so equality of integer is a primitive. And this works because the type of this is int to bool. The type of this equality function is char to bool. This is very interesting. This says, okay, I need equality on pairs, right? Because that's what we used. Beep. I have to get forward and backward right. There we go. That's what we did here. We're saying we know how to compare pairs for equality. How do we do that? We'll use the equality function for each element, right? This pair is equal to this pair if the first components are equal and the second components are equal. So that says we can define equality for pairs as long as we know equality for the components. And that's exactly what this says. If you know how to define equality on type A, and you know how to define equality on type B, then you know how to define equality on AB pairs. Right, the pair UV is equal to the pair XY if U is equal to X and V is equal to Y. Similarly, for lists, we can check that two lists are equal as long as we know how to compare the elements of those lists. So this says if we know how to do equality for A, we can do equality for list of A. Right, it's just the definition to expect. The empty list is equal to the empty list. The empty list is not equal to any non-empty list. Any non-empty list is not equal to the empty list, and two non-empty lists are equal if the heads are equal and the tails are equal. So notice that every time I've used equality here, it's at a different type. Right? This is general equality. This is equality on integers. This is equality on characters. This is equality on pairs. This is equality on the first component of the pair, the type A. This is equality on the second component, the type B. This is equality on AB pairs. This is equality on lists of A. This is equality on the type A itself. This is equality on lists of A. So this is actually a recursive definition. So every place we've written equality, it can have a different type. And the Haskell compiler just works that out for you. Now, it turns out there's a very easy way of understanding what this means. We can explain our function. Okay, so this, Sorry, I just have to get used to forward and backward. Right. So here's an ordinary function in Haskell with type classes. Now I need to explain to you exactly what this means. So here's the technique I'm going to use to explain exactly what this means. I'm going to give you the same thing. I'm going to give you an equivalent program that has exactly the meaning of this program written in Haskell without type classes. So I can explain Haskell with type classes by translating it to Haskell without type classes. Right? This is a theme that we've seen in this course again and again. You explain Haskell by translating it to a smaller language, lambda calculus. We explain Haskell with type classes by translating it to a smaller language, Haskell without type classes. It's a generally useful technique. Explain one language by translating it to another language. Later, this is earlier. So here's the translation. Sorry, that's the definition of the type class. So this is Haskell with type classes, and again, I'll have to change it to Haskell without type classes. So here's the first part of the translation. I'm going to define a new abstract data type, or a new algebraic data type, ecdict of A, which is just basically the thing that contains the equality function. If my type class had more than one function in it, and some do, this would have one field in the constructor for each function in the type class. So here there's just one thing, equality. So the thing that's called the dictionary has just one function in it. The name class comes from object-oriented programming. You'll learn more about that when you learn about Java. And the name dictionary also came from object-oriented programming. So this is sort of how you do object-oriented programming in Haskell. So, and then eek is passed an extra argument, a dictionary, and it just extracts the equal function from that. If there was more than one thing, you'd have one function for each thing, and you'd extract each function. So for instance, for ord, there are four functions, less than or equal, greater than or equal. And so you'd have four things like this to extract those four functions from the dictionary, which would just be essentially a four-tuple, an algebraic constructor with four fields. Now, here's the secret, and it's very easy. It's almost like a pun. Here's how we translate these things. Every time in the type, you see one of these double arrows with a type class, we're just going to turn it to a single arrow and pass in the corresponding dictionary. So type classes just correspond to extra arguments to the function that are created for you by the compiler based on the type. So what happens with our four definitions? They stay just as they are. We get one extra argument, which is the dictionary. And everywhere that before we said x equals y, we instead extract the equality function from the dictionary and then apply that to x and y. So ecd is going to be an equality function, and that then gets applied to x and y. This is a place where currying really helps us. So you see the three different places that equality appears. I just extract equality from the dictionary. Know that for the section, it works out very neatly. It's just the equals x function is ecd applied to x. Okay? And then before where it said ec of a, double arrow, it now says ecd for equality dictionary of a, single error. And then each instance becomes a function that creates dictionaries for us. So the instance for integer is just a dictionary containing the equality for integers function. For characters, it's just a dictionary containing the equality for characters function, which is defined just as before. It's equality on integers of the ords of the characters. For pairs, right, remember the type before was eq a, eq b, double arrow, eq a, b. So it becomes take two dictionaries, take a pair of dictionaries, and return a dictionary for pairs. And this is just, so the function takes two dictionaries, d a and d b. It returns dictionary for the function f, where f of u, v, and x, y is defined just as before, where equals on a is replaced by equality over the dictionary for a, and equality for b is replaced by equality but for the dictionary for b. And similarly for lists, right, we just take one dictionary, the f function is defined just as before, except equality over d is replaced, sorry, equality over type a is replaced by the corresponding dictionary. Oh, and look, equality for list of d is replaced by equality for the dictionary for lists of D, which is what we're defining. So this is recursive, just as we'd expect. And then when we use the function, right, before, remember, we had lm1, 2, 3, 4. Now it passes an extra argument, which is the dictionary for integers. Here we're doing using characters, so it passes an extra argument, which is the dictionary for characters. Here we're using a pair of an integer with a character, so it passes an extra argument, which is the dictionary for pairs applied to the dictionary for integers and the dictionary for characters. Here we've got a list of characters, so the extra argument is the dictionary for lists applied to the dictionary for characters. So Haskell just makes up these arguments for you based on what it knows about the types. So, right, I've written this here in blue, large letters, right? You can guess what that means. That means jump up and down. Isn't this cool? Haskell is writing part of the program for you based on what it knows about the types. What could be neater? And that's all the type classes are about. It says, look, I want you to use this systematic way of passing around arguments based on what the types are. Right? And the nice thing is, equality is built into Haskell. Order, right, comparison operators, less than, greater than, and so on, is built into Haskell. Show functions are built into Haskell. So all these different things are defined at lots of different types. But if you had your own function that you want to define at lots of different types, you can just do it in Haskell using type classes. And you don't realize it, but you've benefited from this enormously because QuickCheck, remember, generates arbitrary instances of things based on the type. So what it's doing is it's using its own set of type classes to generate arbitrary instances of things. If you define your own type, there's a way of using type classes to define your own instance of the class, which is called arbitrary. And then you can do quick check for yourself over other data types. If you look at some of the programs we've given you, some of them for testing purposes include a bit of code to define an instance for the type class arbitrary to help you with your quick check testing. If you define your own new data type, you can define your own instance of a class of the class arbitrary to do some testing. Right? But John Hughes and Kuhn Klassen, when they first defined QuickCheck, it wasn't built into Haskell, and they didn't need it built into Haskell. It's still not built into Haskell. They could just define their own class arbitrary and their own instances of the class arbitrary. So being able to use this technique of defining things at arbitrary types is very useful. We'll see some examples. Which way am I going here? We've seen that. We've seen that. Right, so here's some other examples of type classes. Right, equality actually doesn't have just one thing in it. I said that to make it short. It's got two things in it, equals and not equals. And if you don't give it a definition for not equals, it uses this one, right? Just not of equals. Similarly for or, it has these four things in it, and three of them are defined in terms of less than. Show just has one thing in it, the show function, which goes from arbitrary type A to a string. So let's look at some other things. No, that's wrong. Right, so those are the type classes, eq, ord, and show. Oh, and notice that ord, you're only allowed to define ord if equality is already defined. Right, and that makes sense because ord has things that like less than or equal, which only makes sense if you know about equality. So for bool, this is easy, right? We've seen how to do this, right? Eq of bool is just false is equal to false, true is equal to true, and any two other things are not equal. Ord is easy. False is less than true. That's true. Any two other things are not less than one another, right? False is not less than false. True is not less than true. And true is not less than false. So all of those give us false. And finally, the show function is easy, right? The show false is the string false and the string true. We've seen this sort of thing before. For pairs, right, we've already seen how to define equality. Less than is very similar. XY is less than X prime Y prime. If X is less than Y prime, or if X is equal to X prime and Y is less than Y prime. That's the usual ordering function that one uses on tuples. It gives you what's called dictionary order. This is sometimes called lexicographic order. It's not the only sensible ordering, right? A different ordering is point order in the plane, which says x, y is less than x, y prime, if x is less than x prime, and y is less than y prime. That's a different ordering. And then to show something, you just show the two components, parentheses around them, and a comma in between. Any questions about this? So let's say we've just got here a pair of an integer and a character. Is 1a less than 2c? How many people think, by this definition, is 1a less than 2c? Is 1z less than 2a? Yes, because 1 is less than 2. We don't look at the second component. Is 1a less than 1z? Yes, because the first components are equal, so we look at the second component. Okay? But 1a, sorry, if we compare 2a with 1z, right, we look at the first component, so 1a is not less than 2z. For lists, right, we've already seen how to define equality on lists. Ordering is very similar. Again, notice we're using essentially lexicographic ordering here. If the first character is less than the second, that's less than it. Otherwise, if the characters are equal, we compare the remainders. This is really dictionary ordering. This will give you dictionary ordering for strings. And then show for a list is fairly straightforward. Now, the nice thing is, if you're defining your own types, you can see there's a pattern to writing those things. You don't need to follow that pattern. Instead, what you could do in Haskell is, if you've got an algebraic type, after you can say deriving and any of the type classes eq, ord, and show that you want, and it will write out the definitions according to this pattern that we've, according to this pattern that we've seen. So you can see I've written this in big blue letters, right, that Haskell uses the types to write the code for you. Because now, right, that was 3 pages of code, and fairly tricky code, that I just showed you, right? Haskell will write all of that automatically for any algebraic type you want. So if you define trees, say, and say deriving eek, ord, show, Haskell will derive suitable notions of equality, comparison, and printing for trees. If you do it for expression types or whatnot, it'll do it for you. I'll show you some examples. Let's see. First, just notice that for sets, remember, sets were an abstract type, the equality that we want for sets is not the equality that you want for the representation, right? Because we were representing sets as lists, and the list 2, 1, 1 and the list 1, 2 are equal as sets, but of course they're not equal as lists. So we need to define equality differently for sets than from lists. And we can just do that, right? We can say there's an instance of equality for sets, which is S is equal to T if and only if S equals T, where equal we saw how to define yesterday. And remember the definition of equal for the list representation sorted the list and removed duplicates. To sort the list, of course, you have to put it in order. So note that equality is only defined on set of A if we have an ordering, not just equality, on the type A. You only need to determine if two sets are equal if you know how to put their elements in order. So remember before we saw how to define the type season, right? A season is winter, spring, summer, fall, and we define functions like next and warm, which seasons are warm. Winter is not warm, spring, summer, and fall are true. Maybe I wasn't in Edinburgh when I wrote that. But we could just say, right, season is winter, spring, summer, fall, deriving eek, ord, show, and also enum, and we'll get lots of code for free. What do we, right, it's like this thing where somebody's on TV selling you sets of steak knives. Not only do you get eek, not only do you get ord, not only do you get show, but also for free you get enum when you get deriving with an algebraic data type. Right? So you get this definition of eek, which is what you'd expect. This definition of ord, and notice that the order is dependent on the order in which you wrote the type definition. So winter comes before spring, spring comes before summer, summer comes before fall. So the definition is such that winter is smaller than spring, spring is smaller than summer, and so on. And, whoops, that's exactly what's written out here. So winter is smaller than every season, spring is smaller than summer and fall, summer is smaller than fall, and then everything else is false. And then show is very straightforward. So all that code you get for free. But there's more. You also get, there's another class called enum, which has in it to enum and from enum, which convert numbers to integers, and then all the things that are used, remember we saw these before, when you write x dot dot y, it really means enum from to applied to x and y. And similarly for the other dot dot forms in Haskell. And they're all just defined by doing the thing on lists of integers and then mapping that you get using from enum and then converting every integer in the list using to enum. So it's very straightforward. Right, so how would you go all the characters from A to Z, convert A to its character code, convert Z to its character code, form the list of those integers, which are their character codes, and then map the function that converts the character codes back to the characters. So it's very straightforward. So then the instance of enum for int is very straightforward, right? To convert an integer to an integer, it's the identity, and the same for from. And second pred increase and decrease. And then all the enum froms, we actually saw how to define those before So these are obvious functions that give you the appropriate list of integers. I won't go into the details here. So now if we say enum season, right, it'll define from again, it uses the order we gave. So from enum of winter is 0, from enum of spring is 1, from enum of summer is 2, from enum of fall is 3, and similarly to enum of 0, 1, 2, 3 give us winter, spring, summer, fall. So this is quite nice. So for free, for each enumerable type, we get a mapping from that type to the integers. So this only works for types that don't have any fields, because those are the enumerable ones. And now next is even easier to define if we wanted to, right? Convert your season to a number, add 1 to it, take it mod 4, and then convert it back to a season. And warm is easy, because we could just say, well, something's warm if it's an element of spring through fall. And then similarly for shapes, if we define, remember we defined shapes before, a shape was a circle of a radius or a rectangle with a width and a height. And we can now do deriving, eq, ord, and show. And we instantly get equality over shapes, order over shapes, show for shapes. Notice that order for shapes is again defined using lexicographic order. So first, given a rectangle, it first compares the widths and then compares the heights. The important thing about this notion is it's a total ordering, right? That's why we use lexicographic ordering. Total orderings have the property that given any two values, either they're equal or the first is less than the second, or the second is less than the first. Not all orderings have that property. Yes?
Would we be able to see the code that Haskell writes for us and
for some scoring? Oh, right. Wouldn't it be nice if you could actually see the code that Haskell writes for you? That should be a compiler flag, but I don't know if it is. I'll have to look that up. If you can't do that, I should suggest that to the authors of the compiler, that there should be something that lets you see that. That's a good idea. Okay, and we remember we saw the expression type before. I'm not going to go through this in great detail. So here's the definition of the expression type. And then we did things like eval. And again, you can derive eq, ord, and show. And so you get all this code for free. Same thing happens with numbers, right? There are a bunch of other classes for numbers. So the class num of A, it presumes you know how to compare things for equality and to show them. And then it gives you also operations plus, minus, and times, which do arithmetic, negate, right, which is the negation of a number, and from integer, which converts an arbitrary integer to a number. It doesn't have divide, because divide doesn't make sense for all numbers. Like, divide doesn't make sense for integers. The numbers for which division does make sense are called fractionals. And then there are other things called reals. And there's some things in these that I've not even explained, like trigonometric functions are within the real class, but I left that out. There's a quite complicated set of type classes for numbers. But the important thing, right, is that for each type, like int and float, plus, minus, star, negate, and from integer are all defined using built-in functions, because the representation for floats and integers is built into the machine. But the mechanism for making plus work on integers and floats and other numbers is just type classes. And this has the advantage that if you have your own class you've defined, like point, and you want addition and subtraction and multiplication to be defined for points, you can do so. And you can all think of classes you might want to define for which arithmetic operations make sense. So this is a nice advantage of using the type class approach. So using deriving, you get built-in instances when they make sense. There are some things for which built-in instances don't make sense, but for which you can define them. In that case, you can define your own instance. That's particularly useful for things like abstract types. So that's a lot of code to go through. I don't expect that you followed all that code. The key lessons that I want you to take away are, first of all, that this is how Haskell makes it possible to have operators like equality, or less than, or plus, that work on many different types. And that when you use an operator like that, it's called, the technical term for it is called overloaded. What we say in Haskell is that belongs to a type class. And that Haskell either defines instances for you as appropriate, or you can define an instance for yourself. And if you define a new type and you want to make sure that the instances are defined for it, you can do that with deriving. Now, I mentioned that this was somewhat like an idea in object-oriented programming. As you'll see when you learn about Java next term, in Java also you can have an operator with a single name, like print, and you can define that for each new type you introduce. So that form is very convenient. However, Java has built-in arithmetic. You can't redefine arithmetic on new types. You'd have to use different names. You can't use the built-in names plus, minus, and so on. Similarly for equality. So there's so the equality that's built into Java is just for a few types, and then there's what's called a method called equal that's defined everywhere and is part of the standard prelude. And you can define that yourself for any new types. But what Java will never do for you is make up its own definitions of equality and ordering and so on, based just on the type declaration. In fact, Haskell is pretty much the only widely used language in the world that does that. The technical name for this is it's called generic programming. And there's a whole research area about how, based on the types, you can automatically derive suitable functions. And there are more and more powerful techniques for this coming along. So I thought this was pretty, so I have to come clean now and say, right, Haskell was invented by many, many different people. Type classes were invented by me and my graduate student, Stephen Blott. And it's one of the most successful things that I ever did, because lots of people used Haskell, and then lots of people came up with many improvements on type classes. So the type class system in Haskell now is much, much better than what I originally designed, because other people came along and came up with improvements on the design. Notably, Mark Jones did a lot of work in this direction. And there are people now, like Oleg Kiselov, who do things with type class. You know how I routinely make your head hurt? Okay. Oleg Kiselov does the same thing to me. I read one of his papers, I go, you can use type classes to do that? Oh my goodness. I never realized that. And more or less, they've managed to prove that pretty much any program that you could write in Haskell at runtime, you can actually write using type classes and do it at compile time based entirely on the types. And so normally you would do arithmetic at runtime, right? You've got 2 and 3 as numbers in the machine. Oleg has figured out how to do really weird things, like have a type that corresponds to the number 2 and a type that corresponds to number 3. So the type class system of Haskell can figure out for you, without running the program, just at compile time, that 2 plus 3 is 5. Now, if that makes your head hurt, don't worry. It makes my head hurt, too. The reason I'm telling you all this is to make an important point, which is if you design something and make it simple, then the best thing in the world will happen, which is if you make it simple enough that other people can understand it, they will come along and make it even better still. So the most successful thing you can do in the world is not to come up with a great idea, but to come up with an idea that's so simple that other people can come along and make it an even greater idea. Right? And you've all used things on the web that have this property, They're good, but the wonderful thing about them is that other people can come along and use them to make their own things that are even better. That, of course, is what's great about a programming language, is that you can come along and write your own programs in it to do great things. That was the original nice thing about type classes. Instead of having just a few operators, like equality built in at a few types, or less than built in at a few types, anybody could come along and define equality or less than for whatever types they want. So, I guess the way you summarize that is like this. Power to the people. Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. See you all next week.